Hello, and welcome to the Icecast. My name is Shane Chebsey. This week, the Icecast is sponsored by Ross C. Hughes, who is a fantasy author. Ross is currently offering 10 free fantasy short stories to anyone who signs up to his mailing list at www.rosshughes.biz. The free stories are a great way to find out whether you like to dive into his epic fantasy convent series, the fourth book of which is scheduled to be published on September the 1st and is called Into the Madlands. You can check out the first book in the series, A Dead Wizard's Dream, now on Kindle for just $2.99. Described by one reviewer as one for the fans of epic sword and sorcery sagas to really get stuck into. His first fantasy anthology, Chronicles of Maradoum, Volume 1, comprised of 11 short stories, is available on Kindle for just 99p. So, are you looking for that next epic fantasy series to really dig your teeth into? Why not check out the free stories and see what you think? Sign up to Ross Hughes' mailing list for 10 free fantasy short stories at www.rosshughes.biz. Thanks to Ross for his support of the show. And now, without further ado, here is episode 4 of the Icecast. Hello, everybody, and this is the Icecast, where we talk to comic artists, writers, and publishers about their work, about their influences, their lives, and everything else in between. My name is Shane Chebsey, and tonight I am very, very happy to welcome to the Icecast the one and only Mr. David Roach. Good evening, David.
Hello.
Very nice to see you after it's been, as we were just saying, a year, isn't it?
Yes. About this time last year, I was locked up in a jail in Shrewsbury.
You're never going to let me live that one down, are you?
No. Well, I mean, it is the best anecdote possible. You know, who else would have a convention set in a jail?
Well, indeed. You can't say it wasn't original.
It was a one-off. Absolutely. Yeah,
it is, because we won't be using that venue again.
But it was different.
Yeah, you've got to experiment, haven't you, and try the things. And it was the first festival, so things that work and things that don't work. For those listening who don't know, I also run a convention called Comic Salopia. Well, it's a festival, actually, and David was kind enough to join us for the inaugural festival. And I think we had a good time, didn't we?
We had a great time. I can say I was locked up in jail with John Wagner.
Yeah.
Not many people can say.
Yeah, there was a few in there, actually, wasn't there? John Wagner, Brian Talbot, and eventually everybody escaped. Some to the castle, some to the university.
We did.
Fun was had. So obviously, as I have done with everybody else that I've spoken to, I want to say thank you very much for joining me. I really do appreciate your time tonight, David.
My pleasure.
And it's always good to see you. And I wanted to talk about your early career initially, because I think most people are aware, aren't they, that you sort of started off in self-publishing. Is that right?
Well, I did a fanzine. Does that count as self-publishing?
Well, definitely. The Hellfire fanzine?
Hellfire it was, yes. Possibly Valuable Collector's Items. Mm. I still have a box of them in my roof, if anyone's interested.
We'll drop the link for the sales later on.
We should do.
Definitely.
I did 4 issues of the fanzine with my brother, and I stuck my comic strips in there, along with comic reviews and interviews. So I had the second ever interview with Alan Moore.
Wow. Well, that's something, isn't it? That's something. Yeah.
How did that go? It went really well. I mean, he wasn't Alan Moore.
No.
Back in 1984, four, I think I interviewed him. I mean,
Yeah.
Warrior had been out for about a year and a half, something like that. So I was a fan. I loved his stuff. But he didn't have hordes of people following him into the loo, which is what happened at UCAC just a few years later.
Yeah, Tony actually, who I was talking to last week, Tony Bennett, told me that story about the fans following him into the toilet. That's just we had a good laugh about
I was there at the convention and I remember
that.
seeing him being trapped halfway up the stairs. I mean, he was a pop star for that period, you know. It was just incredible.
It must be quite hard to deal with that sometimes, especially if you're not ready for it, if you're not expecting it. You know, you're jobbing away, you're just doing your job, being an artist, being creative, and then suddenly this extra dimension of celebrity hits you. You know, especially back then, I would say artists were not at all prepared for it, were they? Would you say?
Well, I mean, most artists didn't ever really have that experience. A few, like Brian Bolland and Dave Gibbons, had it to a lesser degree, but not like Alan Moore had back then. I mean, it was just extraordinary. And it was in such a short amount of time. If you consider, it was 84 when I interviewed him. And really, there were only about 10 of us there at a talk he was doing at a tiny convention in Cardiff called the Cymru Con.
Why?
And yet, 3 or 4 years later, he was in the NME and being quoted on television and that sort of thing. It was an incredible transformation. I can assure you, most of us, even now, don't quite have that degree of adulation.
That's probably, it's probably for the best, isn't it? When it comes to creating work, I think sometimes that too much of that can be a bit of a distraction, perhaps.
I wouldn't know.
Oh, you're very modest. So we're aware of the sort of starting point for your work, as it were, as a comic creator, a publisher, writer, lots of strings to your bow. But before that, what was your inspiration? What made you want to be predominantly, you know, this creative person in comics? What did you have a love of comics as a medium?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was just besotted with comics. I really was. You know, I can remember endless trips to far off news agents dotted about Cardiff trying to find the latest comics. I mean, my local one had Marvels, but if I wanted DC's, I had to go somewhere else. If I wanted Charlton's or Atlas Comics, I had to go somewhere else. It was just a quest to always find it. Oh no, I mean, I just loved them. Absolutely adored them.
And part of the fun was that quest, wasn't it? Like now there's the direct market. Back then there wasn't the direct market that we have now. So it really was, you know, you had to hunt down a lot of stuff, didn't you?
We didn't have a specialist comic shop in Cardiff until about 78, 79, something like that. So I would make occasional trips to Bristol or London to look for what we used to call non-distribs comics that didn't come over. And there were key titles like, you know, there were 6 issues of the X-Men that didn't come over. You know, I can remember going into a shop in Bristol and picking 8 or 9 John Carter, Warlord of Mars's. And I was just thrilled, you know. Everything was precious. We did have second-hand shops, which was great for finding old comics. But, you know, I can remember I found a Kid Colt from 1972, and it seemed ancient. It was such a treasure. Tragically, the comic was not that great, but it felt special because it was that old, you know.
And the thing is, back then, I mean, obviously, I don't remember quite as far back as you, but I remember reading comics and reading them, really reading them. Like, I'd have a comic that my mum maybe bought me as a kid. And I'd read it 5, 6, 7, 8 times, just constantly going through it, looking at the story, drawing every panel, you know, copying the art, you know, and just devouring it as an item, Whereas now people, you know, I think we, with the direct market and the comics as a commodity, we buy it, might read it, stick it in a bag with a board in a box, never to be seen again, you know, and that joy that, you know, of your early years with comics, you can never really recapture that, can you?
No, I totally agree. The first comic that I bought myself up at my local newsagents, and the one that really got me interested in comics, was called TV Action.
Ah, right.
Which had Doctor Who and UFO and strips like that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I still look at it today. Mm. But I read them again and again. And particularly looking at the artwork, just trying to imagine being able to draw that well.
Yeah, yeah. And what's their secret, you know?
And it had some of the best artists around. Yeah, it had John M. Burns, mm. Jerry Haylock, Jose Ortiz, Bardia Romero.
Wow.
Really, really top artists.
Mm, mm.
And some of the issues which I was able to get in jumble sales, my school jumble sales, had reprints of Frank Bellamy and Ron Emmett.
Yeah. Yeah, they printed a lot of stuff in TV, didn't TV 21. They seem to get licenses for various reprints, and as well as having, you know, licenses for stuff that was current, there was a lot of really interesting stuff in there as well.
There was.
Yeah. It was a real nice mixed bag, wasn't it?
It was. And even at a young age, certain artists and certain styles really spoke to me. I really connected with them.
Yeah.
And the people that I mentioned just now, you know, I could see they were better than the others. Mm. But beginning to sort of approach that sort of skill, it seemed impossible. You know, how could anybody draw that well? You know, you look at Jerry Haylock's painted covers with Doctor Who. Even now, I look at them and I think, how did he do it? They are so extraordinary. Yeah. And that's why I've put so many of them in my latest book.
Yeah. And I want to talk about that a little bit later on as well. Definitely.
I never say no to a free plug.
So those were the artists basically that inspired you to become an artist yourself, would you say?
To a degree.
But there was other influences as well?
Well, yeah. I mean, a little while after that, I discovered American comics.
Hmm.
And they seemed somehow more approachable.
Yeah.
So, you know, I loved the British artists, but someone like Haylock or Bellamy, I mean, it seemed they were untouchable. They were so good.
Yeah.
With the American comics, it somehow seems slightly more achievable.
Yeah, a bit like punk, you know. It's like if you're a musician in the 70s, you know, you're listening to all this really technical prog stuff and you're like, I can never play like that. Mm. But you hear punk and you think, that's brilliant and I think I can do it.
Yeah. So Marvel Comics were the sort of the equivalent of the Cockney Rejects is basically what you're saying.
Definitely.
Here.
I definitely felt that even then, you know, I wouldn't have put it like that because I didn't have the awareness. Yeah. But even at a young age, you know, when I was reading Marvel, it felt like this is a little bit more my thing. This is something I feel I can aspire to and maybe achieve, you know, this sort of art. Whereas I was the same, you know, I'd look at, you know, the British stuff and just think these guys are like incredible illustrators who are, there's just no way I'll be ever able to touch that stuff. You know? And I think if you feel that you can do it, you're more inclined to think, oh, you know, and I think that's the attraction of self-publishing for a lot of people. It's like, well, oh, I can do that. So I'm going to have a go. And you get more into it. Whereas if something's just beyond you, you just feel that it's on another planet.
Yeah. I was deluded. I mean, it goes without saying. I think you need to go into these things with a degree of delusion and ego to imagine that you could ever get to that sort of level.
Definitely, definitely. Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the thing about punk, it's like, it's not just about playing three chords, is it? You know?
It's being able to write a memorable tune as well.
Yeah. And it's having something to say, you know? Yeah. Well, in any art, really.
Yeah.
You want to say something. You've got to communicate something. If you've got nothing to say, it doesn't matter how good you are technically. You know.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true.
So you had this like double influence. You had all of the great Brits. You had all the great Americans. Like I'm probably guessing people like, you know, the classics, Gil Kane. And all those sort of guys from the 70s.
Kane and Kirby. You know, I was picking up the British reprints by the mid-70s. Planet of the Apes is the one I particularly liked.
Yeah, that was good.
So you'd have people like Alfredo Alcala in there, as well as lots of Gil Kane reprints.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about those magazines, the Planet of the Apes, because I used to pick up those. I got them secondhand from my cousin because he's older than me. And they were quite illustrative, weren't they, those Planet of the Apes? They sort of straddled the American and European style quite well, because a lot of those artists were sort of European, weren't they?
They were Filipino.
Yeah, and Filipino, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think when I was about 13 or 14, I discovered Warren Comics with... Hence, Vampirella.
And she's been with you ever since.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I just adored that stuff. I really did. Spanish artists are just... And again, I had this moment when I bought my first Vampirella and Pepe Gonzalez drew the lead strip in it. And it was the same feeling I had when I saw Jerry Haylock's Doctor Who covers, because Pepe Gonzalez could just draw... brilliantly, and some of the panels were incredibly realistic. And I was looking at it thinking, well, how is this humanly possible? But I copied a few of the pages, and to my way of thinking, they looked halfway decent. And it was a moment where I sort of began to think, well, maybe I actually could do this.
Yeah, it looked in reach. It looked like you were the beginning of the journey, but you had a ways to go. Is that how you felt?
And I was just copying him as well.
Yeah, you went doing your own. Yeah, that's a different copying. Thing altogether, isn't it? Yeah.
No, but I remember bringing my sketchbook into school. This was the beginning of high school, showing it to the art teacher. And she said, you know, actually, this is good. But I know you can draw comics. How about let's see you drawing real stuff?
Yeah.
So... from that point on, I didn't really draw many comics. In fact, I didn't draw any comics when I was growing up. Not really.
Right. Okay.
I liked the illustration side of it.
Yeah.
But I wasn't as interested in telling stories.
Right. Yeah. Because that's the integral thing about comics, isn't it? They're not just about art. They're about telling stories. And if your interest is purely in art, there are lots of other mediums and art forms that can sort of inspire you.
Well, I was always pulled in so many different directions, you know, discovering fine art. I used to go to art galleries all the time and buy art books. I can remember discovering Gustav Klimt when I was 17 or 18.
Yeah.
And again, I just thought, how have I not seen this before? You know, this is fantastic.
It's a hell of a discovery, someone like that, isn't it? Yeah. I was about the same age, I think. I was at art college, and Klimt and Egon Schiele and people like that.
Yeah,
you discover all that stuff, and it's like a whole world of art history has opened up to you.
Absolutely, yeah. And then I went to art college and did fine art. So again, there were all sorts of different influences coming in there. But it's, I don't think you ever really stop looking and stop discovering new things. Certainly, that's what I found.
Yeah.
Which again, it's why I've done so much writing and done so many books over the years, because it's just this constant quest to somehow find out what's out there. How does it all fit together? How can you make sense of all this? Contextualizing it somehow.
That's a difficult task, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
definitely. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, there's so many times when I've Googled a particular artist because I'm trying to find out more to write about them, and the only information is stuff that I wrote first time around.
So there's nothing new, just stuff you've already discovered.
Exactly. I thought, well, I can't be the expert. There must be somebody who knows more than me.
I think expertise just creeps up on you, doesn't it? You know, because you're the person who actually did the work, went out, did the research, wrote the books, wrote the articles. I mean, sometimes that's all. It really is about being a doer as opposed to a procrastinator. And I think that's probably, you know, to your credit, why you've become an expert in so many of these areas, because you've just gone, you've done it, you've done the work.
Perhaps it's because I'm extremely antisocial and have no friends. Most people would be, they'd be out meeting their friends, whereas I'm at home typing away, trying to find information on these people, or drawing, you know.
Yeah. It's a solitary existence being an artist, a writer. You know, it's the amount of artists and writers that I've interviewed, not just on this, but, you know, over the years at shows and spoke to and just in bars. The same thing keeps coming back. It's really solitary. If you've, you know, anyone worth their salt who cares about their craft or their art, it, you know, you've got to accept the fact that you're going to spend a good chunk of your time completely alone. You know,
unless you were Steve Dillon and Tom Frame, who used to take their work to the pub,
just draw on the. I've heard those stories. Yeah, there'd be artwork on the tables.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Absolutely. Hey, more power. Or Rob Liefeld and, you know, do your inking in the car while you're driving. I don't know if you've ever seen that video.
Seriously?
Yes. He was inking Hawk and Dove. While driving, because he was going to miss his deadline. So there's a video on YouTube, you know, if you want to see it. It's quite unusual. Yeah.
Don't try this at home, kids.
Yeah, don't try this at home, kids. It's not a good idea.
No.
But that was his dedication to his art. So moving forward a little bit then, we had this period where you were doing self-publishing, but as we all know, you've also worked for 2000 AD. So how did that come about? Was that because you made a concerted effort to meet editors, or did you get snatched up from other work that you'd done?
What other work? I've never worked.
Well, the work that you'd done in your fanzine. Did that help you sort of get work?
It was actually very, very simple. I was at UCAT, must have been 1985, I think.
Right. Yeah.
I had copies of my artwork with me that I'd done for my fanzine. And I was just talking to various people to see if I could get interviews done for the next issue. I must have shown my stuff to Cam Kennedy. He went off that evening and just mentioned me to Steve McManus.
Right.
So on the Sunday of the convention, I was walking around and someone said to me, Steve McManus wants to speak to you. And it sounds wildly improbable as I'm saying this, because I don't know how it all happened. So then I found him. He looked at my stuff and he said, well, when you get out of art college, which would have been the following summer, draw us a couple of pages of samples, send them off. If we like them, we'll give you a job.
Right.
So nice. I left art college. I did a page of Judge Dredd and a page of a girl blowing up a car.
And did you finish your term, or did you just leave art college when he said that?
No, I finished I finished the term. I don't think I was ready at that point.
Yeah.
I don't think I was ready when I actually did my samples, quite honestly. But one of the samples was pretty slick. I mean, it looked okay. So he gave me a job.
Wow.
Really? So from, you know, there was never a period when I was unemployed. I left college and just started drawing for 2000 AD. I was meant to start off doing Future Shocks.
Yeah.
Which is how they would typically sort of break you in.
Most artists, start that way, don't they?
Even some of the big names. I was waiting for this writer, this new writer they'd found, to do some stories, but he never did. And this writer was some chap called Grant Morrison, I believe. I think that's what they told me.
Yeah.
But he never got round to it. But in the meantime, Pat Mills saw my samples and he saw the one with the cute girl blowing the car up. And he was writing Nemesis Book 8, which focused on purity. So he needed somebody who could draw girls.
Yeah.
Not many 2000 AD artists really could do, because that's not their speciality.
Yeah, yeah. And you'd done a lot of that already. You had an interest in a lot of female characters, you know, already, and you've taken it.
Yeah.
And your style was very, I guess, even then, quite illustrative and realistic.
I mean, I was trying. that's what I was hoping for. Yeah. I came in at just the right time. So a lot of the original artists were leaving or had left by 1986. Because, of course, Kev O'Neill had gone. I think Brian Talbot had just left. So there was a gap for...
They were getting snapped up, weren't they? They were getting snapped up by the American publishers.
Yeah. So I started drawing Nemesis. And then a week later, John Hicklinton, I think, started drawing the next book. We were drawing them at the same time.
Right.
And then about a week after me, Simon Bisley and SMS were brought in. So we all came in within a few weeks of each other. That was my recollection of it.
Yeah.
Now, the other three were discovered by Pat. So there was John Hicklinton, SMS and Simon Bisley. So Pat brought them in.
Right.
But I was Steve McManus's sort of discovery, as it were.
Yeah.
But Pat liked my stuff. So that was it. That was my first job, other than being a paperboy, was drawing Nemesis Book 8.
That's quite a leap, isn't it? Paperboy.
It is.
Nemesis with Pat Mills.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Whoa.
I did some inking for Mike Collins
on
a few things sort of around that same time. He did some dreads and I did background inks and just anonymous stuff like that.
Right. So you weren't credited for that work. You just
No.
You just did it for the you know, it was just a bit of paycheck money and
Yeah.
And I hear a lot of guys talk about that sort of inking, you know, just doing the job, you know, for no credit.
I mean, Mike's always taken so much on that it was a strip called Fairly Hyperman, which is a two-part dread story. And I mean, Mark Farmer was inking some of it. Mm. I don't know why he couldn't ink all of it, but I did various pieces trying to ink it vaguely in his style. I think. I haven't dared looked at it in a long time.
I was just going to say, what did you get out of that? Did you learn anything, or did you find new ways of working just from trying to emulate another inker?
Yeah. I mean, I've always looked at other people for inspiration.
Mm.
So I don't think anybody comes into comics or art fully formed.
No.
You know, I think you're always coming from somewhere else. Even someone like Mick McMahon or Kevin O'Neill, they will have had their favourites growing up. It may end up looking very different and very unique, but certainly we all come from somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, my inspirations were just in the millions. It was everybody I ever looked at. But a lot of it was Spanish, certainly. Spanish and Filipino and all this sort of stuff. Italian, you know.
And you can still see that now, actually, in your stuff, I think. There's still that European influence and Filipino influence in just in the aesthetics of it, you know, and the line work. And obviously, you can see all that other stuff as well. And it really is a really nice mishmash of all those influences. That, you know, just unlike every artist, it just comes out as something completely unique, doesn't it?
But that's the hope, certainly. Yeah.
So after 2008, or maybe during 2008, I know that you did some stuff for DC as well. How did that come about?
Well, it was all after 2008, because I did nothing but Judge Anderson for something like 5 years.
Yeah,
it may not have felt like that in the comic, but that was my day job, just doing Judge Anderson day after day.
Yeah.
But at UCAC, must have been 91 or 92, I got talking to Mike Richardson of Dark Horse Comics.
Right.
And he asked if I would like to draw Aliens. So I said, yeah, great.
Yeah, that's a good fit, actually.
I did Aliens for them. Then I did Star Wars, which was the biggest selling comic I've ever been involved in, because it was selling a quarter of a million copies.
gosh.
Can you imagine?
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Then after that, because Alan Grant was writing Batman, he said to me, why don't we do a Batman together?
Ah.
He asked DC and they said, sure. So we did a comic called Batman Demon, which was a prestige format.
I have a copy, actually. Ah. Actually, it's got your signature on it.
The ones without signatures are rare. Than the ones outside.
Like, that's so funny. Like Charlie always says that about Walking Dead comics, you know. It's yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It's in silver pen as well.
Very classy.
Yes, very. Yeah, but I enjoyed that book actually.
It was a good story.
Yeah.
I tried my best on the art, and I can see things that worked and things that don't work. I killed off Mike Collins on page 3. I don't know if you've noticed that. He's one of the
one of the
hoodlums at the beginning.
Oh, right.
we always crop up in each other's comics.
Yeah.
Both of us are on the cover of Dark Stars number 9, running away from a dinosaur.
Oh, I've got that. I'm going to have to check that out.
And I did a Judge Dredd story called... A Whole New Dredd, I think it was.
Right.
Where Dredd had a new uniform which came to life or took over and then ran off, leaving him naked. So in the story, he goes around looking for clothes and runs across Mike Collins, who I dressed as a member of the Bay City Rollers with a sort of... Have you ever seen Uncle Buck, you know?
Yeah.
John Candy's got this big sort of hat thing on. Mike had a hat like that. So I took all these photos of Mike with the hat on, and Dredd mugs him and runs off with Mike's hat, dressed as a member of the Bay City Rollers.
I just got a picture in my head of Mike in a Bay City Rollers garb. That's just... Oh, I'm going to have to check that out. I'm going to have to find that somewhere. Someone I know must have that book. Fantastic. Yeah. So that was quite a different type of book for you, the Batman Demon book. And any other stuff for DC? Any other sort of like Batman or anything?
Well, I then did a lot of inking for them.
Yeah.
I'm very, very slow at drawing. I just, I don't know. My hand just seems to move slowly. I can't explain it. I mean, I've shared a studio with Mike in the past.
Yeah.
And his hand moves 3 or 4 times more quickly than mine.
He's very fast, isn't he? Yeah,
it's incredible. It just flows out of him.
Yeah.
But I am quick at inking, particularly inking other people. So I became a regular Batman inker. So I was in Detective, Batman, Batman Annual, 80-page Giant, you name it. Inked a lot of Jim Aparo.
All right.
And Graham Nolan and Mike Diodato.
Yeah.
All sorts of people. And I inked Green Lantern, Green Arrow, not together. I drew a Star Trek miniseries, and I also inked some Star Trek, some Babylon 5, and just, there was a good sort of 10 years mostly working for America and doing lots of stuff for Dungeons & Dragons as well, which...
Yeah, see, that's a different style again, isn't it? The Dungeons & Dragons stuff, because that's, fantasy for a start. It's more illustrative. How did you find that? Did you take longer to do that stuff? Was it a different type of deadline?
The deadlines were easier. That's my recollection of them. So I had a lot more time. And I did them in all sorts of different styles. So some would be pen and ink, others would be wash. One book wanted everything in pencil. So these are things like monster manuals and modules, that sort of thing.
Right.
So it was mostly Dungeons and Dragons, but I did cards for Harry Potter and... Jihad. There was a vampire game called Jihad.
That'd never get made now, would it?
No, that was not a wise choice.
And you did stuff for Wizards of the Coast as well, did you?
Well, that's the Dungeons and Dragons.
That's the Dungeons. Ah, right, got you. Yeah. Sorry. Going back to your great love for Vampirella, you've also written books
about the character, as well as doing some wonderful illustrations, as I can see behind you there on your. Yes, I should take a little photo of the screen just so that we can show everybody that, if you don't mind, David, I'll just take a little photo of that, because that's a lovely illustration.
That's the cover of Vampirella, Vampy's Fairy Tales number 3.
Right. So
an actual comic book cover.
It's fantastic. And are these reference of real ladies? Because I know you do a lot of life drawing. I've seen your wonderful life drawings that you do, studies, you know, of the human figure, and also the way you draw folds in cloth is just astounding. I know that there's a lot of patience involved in that, being an artist myself.
I commend
your dedication to that. These illustrations that you do of Vampirella, I assume that you've used reference for these, because they're very realistic.
It's very hard to make up this degree of realism. So the picture there, I had one of the life drawing models pose for me. There were two different models who posed for the various Vampy covers I did. So I take the basic pose and the shading and so on. Very often I don't really change them too much, but the face is the big thing.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, there's a look for Vampirella.
Yeah.
Which is basically how Pepe Gonzalez drew her, and Enrique and San Julian did the covers. And it's just, you can't put your finger on it. But there's something about the character that just is very specific.
Yeah.
And I've got to try and capture it. So the faces are sort of made up. They're my redrawings of the actual model to make it look.
A vampy version of the model.
Yeah, the vampy version.
Yeah, because she, like you say, the character conveys a lot of confidence and power. After all, she's a vampire, you know, and not just any vampire. So she's not a human woman. So she has to look something a little outside of human. And it's quite hard to convey that sometimes, you know, unless you've drawn the character as many times as you have.
It's a sort of a European sensibility as well. I mean, the original artist of Vampirella was Tom Sutton, and Jim Warren felt that he'd never really captured how he saw the characters looking. Pepe Gonzalez, he absolutely got her.
Just nailed it.
Yeah, totally. Because he was bringing in this sort of drew romance strips. So it's basically sort of a Spanish romance character.
Yeah. But sort of a really strong, sort of powerful woman who demands the attention of the page. Yeah. I mean, it's
absolutely.
She's a great character. You know, whether or not you read them or not, you know, it's you've got to give it due that the character is iconic.
Yeah. Well, I love the strip. As soon as I discovered the comic, I started ordering it from my local comic shop in Cardiff here. So I was a regular reader. And then I went and got all the back issues as well. And I used to, I had the sort of a board in my bedroom, and I would put the comics in plastic comic bags, you know, and pin them up in the corners of the bag.
Yeah.
So they were sort of like homemade Vampy posters on the wall.
I think every comic fan has done that at some time in their life. You know, they've wanted to display their comics in some way. Just to say,
absolutely.
This is the thing that I love. And then they realise that if sunlight gets on them, they're going to fade. And they put.
Well, you know, but with my bag concept, you could change them all the time. So you could have different comics up there.
Just have them for a short while. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. If I'd thought I could have got it from America, I would have sent off with the 6-foot poster, but it just seemed, America seemed so far away back in the 70s. You couldn't imagine sending off to something from America.
Yeah. No, never. I mean, you couldn't for a lot of stuff, could you? I mean, I remember seeing all the ads in the American comics and just thinking that this stuff is just amazing. You know, X-ray specs, sea monkeys. You know, these are the things of legends. You know?
They are.
I've since bought sea monkeys and they're very disappointing.
Yes. So have I. Nobody was sitting around smoking a pipe. I mean, come on.
That's the thing. They didn't look at all like the advert.
No, it was such a con.
The X-ray specs.
And what about the atomic submarine? I bet it wasn't a real atomic submarine.
Definitely not. What they could get away with in those ads back then.
Incredible.
You know, they even tried to say that, you know, that Twinkies were nice. Oh, I've tasted Twinkies. They're revolting.
Honestly, back in, I think it would have been 1981, my brother and I went on holiday to New York City for the first time.
That's like a pilgrimage, isn't it, for a comic?
Well, it was, because we actually went to Marvel Comics as well.
Oh, wow.
But the very first thing we did, genuinely, after leaving the hotel, was go to a corner shop and buy Hostess cupcakes and Hostess Twinkies. Just because of the adverts that we'd grown up reading in Marvel and DC comics. And of course, they were disgusting. They were the sweetest, gooeyest things.
They're horrible, aren't they? I went over to see the first time I went to the States, my friend got married out there and lives there now still. So I went over to be best man for his wedding. And I think one of the first things he said to me, you know, as I went into the house, is like, I've got Hostess fruit pies. Because we're both comic fans, you know. I've got Twinkies. You've got to try them. He says, and he never told me how horrible they were. He just wanted to see my face as I ate my first one, and the look of disappointment on my face.
I know. Can you not believe anything? I mean, it was so disillusioning.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. The illusion was shattered, you know. So you've done a lot of writing. We go back to the writing, and you've written about Vampirella.
Several books on Vampirella.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And so what made you, before we talk about a specific book, the new book, what made you... want to go into the history? So we've talked about it a little bit already, but what made you make that decision to say, I'm going to publish a book, I'm going to write a book? Was it because you'd done the work in the magazines and you'd done a little bit with the Comic Illustrator as well, was it? Or Comic Artist magazine?
Comic Book Artist magazine.
Did that sort of seep into doing books, or was that just a different ambition altogether?
No, I mean, Comic Book Artist was where it all started, really. Yeah. I mean, I'd done other writing for things like Fancy Advertiser. I was in a couple of issues of Escape reviewing comics. Paul Gravett was a friend of mine.
Yeah.
From when I was starting to sell my fanzine.
Right.
So, you know, and I'm still friendly with him now. I find the people that I hung around with when I was a teenager, I'm still seeing now. You know,
right, that's
still
nice.
Still got the same interest. Paul Gravett's been there off and on, all this time. But in Comic Book Artist, I started writing for with issue number 4, I think it was, and I was in most issues after that. We wrote about Warren Comics, and then the editor, John Cook, decided that we would take that issue as the basis of a complete book about Warren Comics.
Right.
Book called The Warren Companion. So we did that together. Then after that, my friend George Khoury did a book about British comics. Mm. So I was sort of an associate editor on that. I was writing for Frank Plowright on some of his sort of guides to American comics.
Yeah, I think I have one of those books.
Yeah, there were 2 or 3 of them published. I've always done it. What can I say? I mean, I've ever since I was about 19 or 20, I started doing lists of comics with my friend Steve Holland.
All right.
And to this now, we've catalogued almost everything.
And this is the Steve Holland that owns the comic shop in Nottingham.
Just no,
this is the other Steve Holland
in
comics,
who does the website Bear Alley,
right?
And publishes all sorts of books about obscure British writers and that sort of thing.
That makes a lot more sense.
And I just got folder after folder in my studio of lists. So you name the comic, I've catalogued it with Steve. My speciality is identifying artists. So for instance, if a comic like Bunty, just because I hate not knowing something, I've seen every issue and I've catalogued every issue and I've identified every artist.
Why?
So that's it's the case with loads of these titles. Romance comics are another particular interest of mine.
Yeah.
Because so many of the Spanish and Italian artists drew them.
Yeah.
And again, if I'm constantly looking for issues I've not seen to sort of finish off these lists. And from that, I'm able to get a picture of what various artists have done, to get a sort of a sense of who did what and when, how it all fits together, how styles evolved over the years. So in the last sort of 10 years, I've done pretty much one major book a year.
Yeah, yeah. You're quite prolific.
I've written or co-written 26 books.
Wow.
Which is a hell of a thought.
That's impressive, Dave. I didn't even realise there would have been that many.
Yeah.
I know of maybe 12 or 13. So it's incredible, really, that you've produced that much work, because writing a book is no mean feat.
I know.
You know this, because you've done it 26 times.
I've done it, yeah. I mean, not all of them have had vast amounts of writing. So, I mean, I did a couple of books of British war cover art.
Yeah.
I did two books with Ryan Hughes about British illustration. Lifestyle illustrations, he called them, and he found the artwork and I was sort of brought in to do a bit of text and artist identification. I've done a few books with Steve Holland about war picture libraries and that sort of thing. So, you know, it all adds up. But in the last 10 years, it's been these really big hardback books about Vampirella, about Jose Gonzalez. I did the book Masters of Spanish Comic Arts, which is a real big one. That was one I was particularly proud of.
I bet there was a lot of passion in that. I bet you really enjoyed the whole process.
Oh, I loved it. I totally loved it. And then the Spanish one led to this.
Ah, and that's what I wanted to talk about next, was your Masters of... The proper title is The Masters of British Comic Art.
Yes. That's right.
Yes, and it came out in April, I believe.
I think the first few issues came out at the end of March. So my timing was absolutely impeccable.
Just in time for COVID-19.
Yeah, that's right.
Because we planned something, didn't we? We planned an event here in Shrewsbury, promo event with you. And I was so looking forward to doing that at the university. It would have been really, really good, you know, and it would have been great to introduce you and the book to readers. But you know, we could still do it in the future, obviously. But
hopefully we will. There's so much to say about these things.
Yeah, and this book. So was this just a natural continuation then from the Masters of Spanish Comic Art? Were you just seeing it as a natural progression from those other books that you'd recently done?
Yeah, I mean, the book that started it off was just called Masters of Comic Art, which most of us bought back in the 70s or 80s, written by P.R. Garriott, which was my introduction to artists like Mobius and Drier and people like this.
Great.
It was a brilliant, you know, one of my favourite books.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, shamelessly swiped the title for my Spanish book. And the Spanish books seemed to be a natural progression from the Vampirella books that I'd done for... I mean, I did things like put together a Vampirella artist edition for Dynamite. Just as another thing which you may not have known I did.
There's so much you've done, David. It's like, this lot. Is why we're interviewing you, to find out all these things that I don't know about.
yeah.
Oh, that's but incredible.
Having done the Spanish book, I was literally just walking to the shops one day and I thought, well, I've done one on Spanish comics. Why haven't I done one on British comics? Yeah. It felt very unpatriotic. So
indeed.
I thought, I'll just sit down and map it out.
Yeah. So what? How did you choose which artists to include? What was your? Did you have a criteria, or was it just like you went with how you felt? What was the process?
It was a very organic process.
Yeah.
So it was a combination of wanting to bring together all the different genres.
Mm.
So people in the past had done books on British comics.
Yeah.
Paul Gravett did a fantastic one, in fact, about 10 years ago, I think it was. I'd say his was the best older book that I was sort of looking at.
For I think I have a copy of that as well.
I'm sure you do. It's really good. But yeah. he dealt in themes, whereas I wanted just to have the artist. So it was a different approach.
Yeah.
But I wanted to have girls comic artists and humour artists, nursery comics artists, just bring it all together. So it was, okay, who's the best of all these different genres?
Mm.
Let's have a spread of artists right from the earliest days of comics up until contemporary artists now.
Yeah.
So automatically you're filling in a lot of names there.
Yeah, and but you must have had hundreds of artists to choose from. Once you look at all those different genres and eras and styles, there's hundreds of artists. So how do you nail it? How do you bring it down to, you know, the artists that you most extensively wrote about?
Well, I put together a list of who I thought were the best.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be the best rather than just the most prolific.
Yeah.
So that... I didn't necessarily want to be hemmed in by artists who were, let's say, historically productive names. I wanted it to...
Otherwise, it just becomes another book that's like all the other books, doesn't it? You don't want to be... you don't want it to be just another book about all the same artists that everyone else writes about.
And I was... What particularly got me was that there aren't many British comics historians.
No.
And they've typically followed Dennis Gifford and people like that, mm-hmm. and gone for the same few names. And it's basically artists that drew for Fleetway in the 50s, drawing things like Thriller and Super Detective. And there's a lot of them in my book, but I don't just want all of them.
No.
You know, these books and articles, they would never mention the girls' comic artists.
No.
And equally, they wouldn't include the contemporary artists as well, because a lot of these older fans tended to hate 2000 AD and things like that.
Yeah, they just did. They just discount it. They don't consider it. Yeah, valid.
That really annoyed me.
Hmm.
But there's a degree of ego involved as well, in that I was thinking, well, look, I've seen possibly more comics than almost anybody because I borrowed collections from friends, so I can say I've seen every issue of Valiant and Tiger and Bunty and June and whatever.
Yeah.
So I felt that I would be well placed to put a list together. So once I sort of vaguely mapped it out, I wrote off to a few people just to see if they'd be interested in publishing it. I assumed that Dynamite would want to publish it.
Mm.
They're very slow in getting back to me anyway.
Right.
They didn't reply at first. So I thought I'd write to Rebellion. Why not? My publishers, I draw
for
them.
Yeah, makes sense, doesn't it?
Well, in a way, except they'd never done anything like this before.
No.
But so I sent it off to Rebellion. They came back to me pretty much straight away and said, this sounds great. Come up to Oxford. So I came up to the Nerve Centre in Oxford. And we just spent an afternoon chatting about it. And that was it. I could go away and do it. And then at some point along the line, when I was working on page counts, they said, well, don't worry about the page count. If someone is good, they should be in the book.
Yeah.
So at that point,
nice.
It automatically became bigger. And I thought, okay, well, we're not worrying about cutting out these great people.
Mm.
So we can have anybody that's great. And they and various people at Rebellion would come back to me with suggestions.
Mm.
There were a few people, they'd say, well, look, I didn't have Eric Bradbury in at first because I thought I had a limit, you know.
Yeah. So you had to cut a few out that you might have put in otherwise.
Yeah. So they said to me, look, you've got to have Eric Bradbury. You know, you're crazy. What are you thinking of?
They had a point.
Yeah, well, okay. The problem, the biggest area of contention was modern artists.
Mm.
Who would we have that would be in? Because we wanted to be inclusive.
Yeah, and it's very easy, isn't it, to have the benefit of history to say someone is great. You know, it's very easy to say that guy who did all that amazing work 30 years ago is great. But it's very hard to say that guy who's done work for 5 years, who hasn't really got a massive fan base yet, is on that level. Because you've got your neck out then, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I had an idea of the people working today that I really loved. So someone like, even though he's my age, I regard him as a sort of a contemporary artist. So someone like Doug Braithwaite, for me, because he was my favourite of the sort of contemporary artists. I just adore his work.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he's incredible. Yeah. In fact, he's very undervalued, I think, underrated by people. So it was exactly people like him that I wanted in the book, because he was just so brilliant. And there were other names like Dave Taylor. His work I absolutely loved, and you know, Fraser Irving, Mark Buckingham, Henry Flint. But I wanted to look beyond 2000 AD and, you know, American superhero comics. So, you know, I was asking people, who's great? Who should I know about? And I even put a request out on Facebook and got an enormous number of names in. A couple of which I hadn't thought of or I hadn't even heard of.
Yeah, and then it makes you go out and you look at the art and you think, wow, I've discovered another artist.
Well, the biggest one for me was Lorenzo Etherington.
Oh, yeah. And
the embarrassing thing is that I had been with him at comic shows in Bristol and Cardiff and so on.
Yeah.
But you know what it's like at conventions for us artists.
Yeah.
I'm there behind my table.
You don't get to see everyone.
I don't. And I genuinely never seen his art. And with somebody came up on Facebook and said, look, you've got to have Lorenzo Etherington. So I Googled him, and literally within a second of seeing his work, I thought, he's brilliant.
Yeah.
He's absolutely brilliant. And it was so different to... Oh, yeah. The work anybody else was doing.
Yeah.
And it was exactly that sort of person that I wanted to bring in the book as well.
Yeah, that's a really good... He's a good choice because, like you say, he is unique. There's no one really drawing quite like that. And his storytelling is quite unique as well. I find the way he puts a story together visually, it's different. And it's really fresh and it's full of energy and there's lots and lots going on. And it's a genre that isn't as popular now as it has been other times in the past.
I mean, that's true, but he's making it work. He operates in a different way to most people. I mean, you know, he's in the Phoenix and so on, but you know, he self-publishes and he's got sort of 30,000 or 40,000 followers.
It's incredible.
His stuff. So it's like he's bypassing the newsstands and just selling stuff directly to people that love his work.
Yeah. And that's the way forward. That is the way forward for a lot of artists and writers, you know. For some people it's the only option, but I think for someone like, you know, the Etherington brothers, I think that is the best option because they have found their audience.
Yeah.
They don't need all that other stuff. They don't need the middleman. They're going directly to their audience. And it's a really loyal, and it's a huge audience. You know, they did so well with their Kickstarter, I think, was a record breaker.
It was absolutely astonishing.
Mm.
Yeah, it was. And there's a few people in the book that are doing work for the sort of small press, isn't the right word, alternative press. So you've got someone like Rob Davis, who's doing brilliant stuff. And Ian J. Coulbard, who sort of goes back and forth from, you know, America to 2000 AD to smaller projects.
Yeah.
I was determined that with the book, I wanted to have this sort of continuity, as it were, to say at each stage in our development as a comic producing country, we've produced these brilliant artists.
Mm.
And it would have been awful if the last section of people working now wasn't the same quality as the work that preceded it.
Yeah, definitely. And it had that breadth as well of styles and genres.
Yeah.
And it just, there's a continuation, isn't there, of that comics heritage. I always do think that comics is a really important part of British heritage that people often, you know, they think of it as an American thing, which I'm astounded by because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, comics were created in Britain.
They were. And that was one of the things that I was particularly keen to point out in my book. I went back as far as I could to find the earliest comic strip.
Mm.
And I mean, we were doing comics way before other countries were. There's just, there's no getting around it. I'm convinced that it was a British creation.
Yeah. I think maybe some other cultures and nations came up with it, you know, because it's sequential storytelling. It's quite a universal thing, isn't it? And I think that maybe other countries and cultures created comics of their own alongside British comics, or maybe, you know, at the same time, or maybe just a little bit after, or maybe in a medium that couldn't be recognised as comics. You know, I think there's always these, like, there are arguments, isn't there, that this piece of artwork was a comic, or this piece of artwork was a comic, and people tend not to agree.
They don't. That's right. But I sort of, you know, I try to have a definition in the book of what actually constitutes a comic. And certainly the examples that I was finding from the early 19th century, they predate anything else I found. That's not to say that there aren't earlier comics out there, but I certainly not found them. I mean, I think we can claim it as our own.
Definitely. And it's definitely part of our heritage.
Yeah, it is part of our heritage. Absolutely. But equally, a lot of people still seem to be... If you're not a comic fan or not a comic reader, it's as if somehow these characters were created by DC Thompson, not by an actual person.
Yeah.
You know, and Dan Dare just was, it was in the Eagle without a sense that it was Frank Hampson's Dan Dare.
You know,
it was a case of trying to sort of bring back the primacy of the artist as creator.
Mm.
And there's a lot of self-interest involved here, clearly.
But it is an important task. It's an important thing to do. And I'm really glad you did that, because I think you're totally right. The amount of people who have no understanding whatsoever of who created what, or that even there was an individual or maybe a pair of individuals that created these amazing characters right across history. You know, archetypal characters in some cases. And I mean, for example, it was Spider-Man Day yesterday, so I posted Happy Spider-Man Day, and thank you to Steve Ditko and Stan Lee for bringing this creation to us. You know, to ram it home that you know, I'm not virtue signaling here at all. It's just I felt really strongly that, you know, whenever you celebrate a character, you must celebrate the people or the person that brought that character to us with their creativity.
And even now, in cases like this, the artist gets sidelined. Back in the days when you could walk into these gallery shops, you could find Marvel canvases, blow-ups of classic Marvel covers, which you can buy for £3,000 or £4,000, I think they were. And they were signed by Stan Lee.
Yeah, I've seen them. I had a big argument with a lady in a gallery in Wolverhampton. She was displaying, it was the Bob Layton Iron Man. You know, we all know the pose. It's a great, I can't remember the issue number, but it's a great iconic Iron Man pose. Big canvas, selling for silly money, signed by Stan Lee. And I went in there and I played dumb. And she said, "Oh, this is a Stan Lee canvas." And I said, "No, it isn't. It's Bob Layton." And I said, "And that over there, that's Jim Lee. And that over there, that's Alex Ross." And she was like, she had no idea. She thought they were drawn by Stan Lee. I'm not disrespecting Stan Lee, but he had nothing to do with that image.
No.
At all.
No. These were comics. that weren't even published while he was working at Marvel.
Yeah.
You know, he has nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
Zero connection.
Yeah.
And these will be comics like Captain America that he didn't even, you know, he didn't create these characters.
Yeah, I mean, the association with Captain America is just, oh, that really boils my blood because...
I'm sure.
You know, and Joe Simon is just forgotten completely. You know, anyway, we could go on about that forever. You know, we could have a good old, you know, miserable old man rant about that. We'd really enjoy it, but maybe everyone else
would. I thought we were still in the first flush of youth, Shane.
hey, man, yeah, sure. You're however old you feel.
That's right.
If people want to get this book at the moment, David, where would they go to? How would they get hold of it?
Well, I feel duty bound to direct the eager young consumer to the Rebellion website, where they can get either the Brian Bolland cover or the limited edition cover, which I drew, which comes with a signed print and so on.
Yeah.
It should be available in their local comic shops if they're open.
Yeah.
I mean, some are open now, yeah. I'm sure. I think
some are open.
Yeah. It's on Amazon. I mean, it's everywhere, pretty much. It was difficult to get hold of back in April.
Yeah.
Because copies weren't shipped quite quickly. And it was selling out.
Yeah.
So, you know, which was quite good to hear.
Yeah, definitely.
I think I got to number 9 or 10,000 on Amazon.
That's good.
We cling to these things.
Yeah. You can't grumble at that, can you?
No.
You know, for a book like this as well, that is, you know, it's not mass media, is it? It's very specialist. You know, it has an audience. So to sell those sort of numbers so early, so quickly.
And I wanted and obviously it's the sort of thing that it's not going to go out of date. So you can buy it. Hopefully it will be there in 5 years' time or 10 years' time. I mean, one of the things I really wanted to do was for American fans or French or Spanish or Italian fans to have somewhere they could go to see exactly who were the British artists, what the British comics look like, because... Mm. We have a really good sense of what their artwork looks like and the scripts that they've done. They won't have a clue what we've published. No. In fact, the vast majority of British readers won't really have much of an idea of what we've published in the past.
No.
I'm sure your upbringing was much like mine in that we were reading 2000 AD, but we weren't really reading much else.
Mm. I mean, I read... everything I could get my hands on, to be honest.
Right.
But that was limited, you know, being, you know, in the 70s and early 80s.
Yeah, I mean, we'd read Commando.
Commando, like Warlord.
Warlord.
Babino, whatever, you know, action.
But if you think about going to your first specialist comic shops, which in your case was probably Nostalgia and Comics, I would guess.
It was actually a shop called The Place in Wolverhampton.
The Place?
Yeah.
Wow.
Closely followed by Nostalgia and Comics in Birmingham. But
yeah. I mean, for me, it was a shop called, Forever People in Bristol.
And then
Dark They Were and Golden Eyed in London, in St. Anne's Court.
Great name for a shop. Oh,
that's fantastic. And in fact, it is more or less opposite Trident Studios, where you'd have Queen and David Bowie and people like that.
Yeah.
Recording their albums. So it's a brilliant, brilliant location.
What a magical time and place.
Yeah. But think about those shops. They weren't selling British comics, were they?
No, it was all American for the most
part. All American. You think about the conventions that we used to go to. You'd get people that drew for 2000 AD. You wouldn't have Frank Hampson or Ron Embleton or people like that. You just wouldn't.
No, there was no interest, was there, from that area of fandom that created the conventions, perhaps?
That's right. It was totally focused on American comics.
Yeah.
Even to the extent of our fanzines, being fanzines about American comics. It was just, I mean, 2000 AD is the total exception because it was like, it was on its own, a little island in the middle of British comics.
Hell of an achievement, to be honest.
It was almost as if, nothing else counted in a strange way.
Oh yeah, totally. And that has remained, you know, that, I mean, when I started getting into self-publishing in the sort of late 90s, I guess it was 94 I started. And, you know, trying to convince people that there were that there were British comic creators still, and that they were producing work of any value was really, really difficult. You know, just to forget self-publishing, just saying British. And it was like, there's no British, no one in Britain draws comics anymore. That doesn't happen. And that was the constant battle I was up against, you know, trying to create this market that didn't at that time exist, you know.
Yeah. And yeah, we have people like Ian Kennedy doing incredible covers for Commando every single month.
Yeah, just putting it out there, just putting it out. But I think a lot of the thing is these guys came from a time when being a comic artist did not mean being a celebrity. Being a comic artist was a profession, a job that you did, and you did it, I think, you know, I might be looking through it, you know, romantically, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they did it with humility and great, you know, craftsmanship and and dedication to their profession. And I don't think there was any, they had any, I don't think they had any desire for massive recognition. Obviously there's always exceptions to that rule, but there was and so that never happened as a result, you know. And the Americans came in, you know, with all their pop culture and Spider-Man and Stan Lee and all these larger than life characters, Jim Steranko, and, you know, all these guys. And
yet,
of course they're going to hit, they're going to be huge, aren't they?
Yeah, of course, of course. And I was there in Birmingham in 1979 to see Jim Steranko come on stage in a white jumpsuit.
And he's even whiter teeth.
Yeah, and you look at him and think, he's Nick Fury.
Yeah, he is
stage.
Nick Fury, yeah.
And yet, at the same time, working in British comics, we had Ron Embleton, Don Lawrence, Mike Noble, John Burns, Joe Calhoun, Mike Weston. These are artists that could hold their own with the best Americans.
Incredible, incredible, incredible. You know,
I remember I was having a meal with Dave Elliott last year or the year before, and I brought some artwork to show him. And I had a page of Ron Embleton from 1962. And he looked at it and he said, in 1962, Jack Kirby had just started drawing the Fantastic Four. Great. This is what Ron Embleton was doing. And the Embleton art was just a degree of sophistication that nobody in America was doing.
No, the draftsmanship. You know,
out of this world.
I mean, there were superior draftsmen in the British industry. And I think there always has been that tradition of great draftsmanship, as well as great storytelling. You know, it's a different style of storytelling. You know, I mean, I don't get me wrong. I love the American storytelling.
Oh, totally.
You know, the action, the way that they, you know, show movement. And I love that stuff. I was brought up on it. But I also love the British storytelling. It's different, but it's just as effective, and it works. And they knew the language of comics, and they've been doing it a lot longer. And like you say, with more sophistication. And you can't you can't help but just be impressed by that.
And the shame of it is, and again, it comes back to wanting to give these artists recognition. If you think about the UCAC conventions that were so big, and can you imagine how great
huge.
It would? Can you imagine if someone like Joe Calhoun had been there?
Oh man, yeah.
And he never came. He was never at a convention. Never had the recognition that he deserved.
Yeah, I was going to say, was he even invited? You know,
that's... I don't suppose he was. It was just, and Mike Weston. You never saw these people.
I remember the first Bristol when Mike, well, not the first Bristol, I think it was the second one, when Mike sort of took over from Kev, and John M. Burns was there. He had a table, you know. And I remember thinking, fuck, it's John M. Burns, man, at a comic convention.
Yeah.
I never thought that'd happen. And then he was at every one, you know. But
yeah.
I never quite got over the fact that, like, one convention, I was doing my little self-publishing thing. He was on the next table, you know. I was on the next table to John M. Burns. This guy, you know, he's a legend. And he's next to me. I didn't know. I didn't say a word to him all day. I was too starstruck.
Those Bristol conventions did have some great British guests. So you'd have, I've seen Sidney Jordan there. I met Sidney for the first time. Martin Asbury was there. I think Don Harley was there at one of them.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't remember that.
But the great thing about the way the comics world is now is that Ian Kennedy is coming to conventions now.
Yeah.
And he is just getting fanboys completely sort of going crazy over his stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's been drawing comics for 70 years.
Yeah.
And only now is he beginning to get any sense of the popularity of his stuff and how much it means to people.
Yeah. Yeah, people are remembering, aren't they? People are saying, this guy shaped these years in my childhood. Or even my formative years of becoming an adult. In a lot of people's cases, you know, the younger fans, they didn't grow up with his work. They were introduced to it maybe later on, and it influenced them as artists. And yeah, I mean, it's huge. And it is nice to see that now they are getting the recognition they deserve, the ones that are still with us, you know.
Yeah.
And every year, it seems, we lose one of these amazing artists.
Yeah, yeah. But
what a heritage, you know, an amazing heritage. And thanks, David, for putting it all into the pages of your book. I haven't read it yet, I'll be honest. I am really looking forward to reading it, though. It's definitely going to be something that I'm going to be reading. And I think I'm probably going to go for your cover, if there's any left. Because I always like the idea of that if the artist, the guy who's written it, has drawn the cover. I like that. I love Bolland, don't get me wrong, but I think that'll be my choice. He's all right, isn't he? He ain't bad. Was he one of the artists in the book? You got him to draw the cover, so I'm assuming he's in the book.
I think, actually, there's more pages by Brian than anybody else. I did do a sort of a sneaky poll on my Facebook page just to find out who was the people that I'm friendly with, who was their favourite British artist.
Yeah.
And Brian was very nearly top.
Yeah,
he was all the way through. Frank Bellamy was top, which I was very surprised by.
Yeah.
So I thought people wouldn't have necessarily remembered him.
Mm.
But he was top, and Brian was a very close second.
Right.
And Mick McMahon was a very close third.
So I like that. I'm really happy to hear that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Mick's got masses of fans.
Yeah.
So those three were way ahead of everybody else. But it was intriguing just to see who was remembered
and
who wasn't.
Yeah.
Again, it's one of the things I wanted to do with the book was to remind people of great artists who they might have forgotten.
Mm.
And I know he's not forgotten, but one of my absolute heroes has always been Gary Leach.
Gary. He's been a guest at my shows on a few occasions.
Yeah, I love his stuff, but he's just not very, he's not been visible in comics for quite a long time.
No.
He does covers now and again. Mm. Done a lot of covers for Garth Ennis books.
Yeah, yeah.
But actual strips in a place that people will have seen,
he's
not as visible. And you can forget. You can forget how great these people are.
Mm.
When I was doing Judge Anderson and looking for artists that would draw Mega City One in a way that I could sort of incorporate into my style, Brian and Gary were absolutely the two people who I looked at. I mean, obviously, Brian for me was always the definitive Judge Dredd artist. Other people would say Mick, or other people would say Carlos Esquerra. I mean, that's totally fine. We all have our favourites.
Of course we do.
But for someone like Gary, I felt that he was almost in danger of being forgotten or being overlooked.
I suppose that's because of the work he's done. That's the titles that he's chosen, or the title of the work that he's got, maybe. It's not been the most commercial stuff, even though the work has always been outstanding that he's produced.
Yeah.
I think a lot of artists have suffered from that. Not a British artist, but someone I know could have been massive if they'd have drawn different stuff. For me, is Alex Toth. You know, obviously he was massive, and he was one of the greatest comic artists who ever lived. But you know, could have been even bigger if he'd have chosen a few more commercial projects. Say
that wasn't the way he looked at things.
Of course not. You know.
He wanted to do his own thing.
Definitely.
It was what would interest him.
Yeah, and I would imagine that would be the same with Gary.
I think so. I think so to a degree. Yeah, yeah. And I think he's sort of a perfectionist. He's not really going to work on a regular monthly strip or anything like that. But everything he's done is just fantastic.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to get scans from Gary. I mean, it took forever to get them out of him, but there's a lot of his work scattered throughout the book, and it just looks incredible. You know, you could see he holds his own with Embleton and Bellamy and Lawrence and all these giants.
Yeah.
That was one mistake I made. It was the one thing that I would change if I could go back in time, because I was determined to get the best scans possible. So almost every page is shot from the original art in the book.
Right.
And I wrote off to all the people I know that were in the book. And I just said, well, give me a scan of something that you're really proud of.
Yeah.
You'll be in the book with Frank Bellamy. And quite a few people just froze.
They were intimidated by that, were they?
Yeah, totally. Totally. They would think, well, you can't put me next to Frank Bellamy. And I was thinking, but you're great. You know, of course you should be in it.
Yeah.
So in a few cases, I had to choose the art for them pretty much.
Yeah.
It was quite a surprise.
Just too modest, some of these guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find, and I'm sure you find it too, you know, some of the greatest artists living are some of the most modest people. You know, they're constantly berating their own work, constantly in doubt, constantly, you know, saying that they're not good enough, throwing work away. I see sketchbooks, you know, of artists who I'm quite close with, and they show me their work that there's no one's ever going to see. And I'm sure you're probably the same. And it's just beautiful stuff. And God, there's a book here. There's a book. Just publish that. That sketchbook, it's beautiful. It's like, no one's ever seen that stuff. It's not my...
I mean, there are people working in comics now, like Steve Pugh and Phil Winslade.
Yeah.
People like this. You know, they're creating some of the best work in the world in comics. And yet you speak to them and they're so self-effacing about it.
Yeah.
They're so modest.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sometimes you really got to shout about this stuff.
Yeah, you've got to let people see it, you know, because sometimes the artist isn't going to do that. Phil's one of those guys, actually, Phil, because I know Phil really well because we were in the band together. And he showed me his sketchbook. Thank you. He showed me his sketchbook one in the rehearsal, just black and white stuff. He was sketching out stuff for the current thing that he's doing for... the magazine, I can't remember the title now, it's gone out of my head
as well.
The female character, it's
set on Mars.
it's a desert, I know that. Anyway, it's gone out of my head. He was showing me like sketches that he was doing for that before it existed, and it was just gorgeous. The line work, it was beautiful lines, just that's all I can say. Just beautiful, beautiful lines.
His stuff is brilliant, and the last convention I went to was Thought Bubble.
Right, yeah.
And Steve Pugh was kind enough to give me a copy of his Harley Quinn comic. I've been really looking forward to seeing. And every page is brilliant. Every panel is perfect. It's so fantastic. In many cases, and I approach people to be in the book, they were just so... knocked out to be included. I was thinking, well, surely you must know you're brilliant. Of course you're going to be there. Of course.
They never know.
There couldn't be any doubt. Once it came out, I did have a few people write to me and they said, am I in it? You know, are you sure I'm in it? Yeah, and I was thinking, I couldn't have dreamt of doing it without putting them in.
Yeah, yeah.
But we do have a lot of talent. We really do.
We do, we do. And great people as well. You know, we're really, we're lucky that, you know, the British industry as a whole, you know, for the most part, is full of really nice people.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree. I agree.
Incredibly talented and really nice. But
I mean,
David,
I really enjoy. Oh, have we finished?
Well, say what you wanted to say, mate. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I can round this up just by saying that I work for 2000 AD and Doctor Who magazine, and have done solidly for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is they are just great people.
Yeah.
They're fantastic to work for. You know, all the crew at Rebellion that I've done projects with now, I mean, they're all fantastic, great people, really enthusiastic. And, you know, my editor at Doctor Who magazine, Scott Gray, is just fantastic to work with. And that makes all the difference.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely.
It really does. You feel that everybody cares about what they're doing.
Yeah.
And it's great not to have to sort of sell your work in America, constantly trying to...
Yeah. You don't need to do that, do you? Not at all.
That's the bit that we Brits are worst at, I think, is the selling ourselves.
Selling, oh, yes, definitely.
The Americans, I don't think, have the same problem at all.
No, no. I think as a, you know, in general, and it is a generalization, obviously, but yeah, I find, you know, working with American creators and British creators is a very different experience, whether it's as a publisher and editor or whether it's as a, you know, a convention organizer. The American guys, they know exactly what they're doing when it comes to promotion, branding, you know, who they are as a brand. They know that shit and they've got it nailed. The Brits are just like, I just want to draw comics.
I know. That's all it is. Yeah. And I should mention in passing as well, another person I haven't mentioned in the book, which I really should do, is my friend Dylan Teague.
Oh, Dylan. My friend too. Lovely guy. Yeah.
I go, in previous times, I would meet him every week at Life Drawing. We would sit next to each other and have done for 10 years now.
Wow.
Every week until April.
Yeah. And then it all comes to an end.
It all comes to an end. But if Dylan was American, he'd be, you know, there'd be a queue a mile long at San Diego waiting to get his autograph. He's, you know, his stuff is so fantastic.
Oh, he's great. I love Dylan. His work is, and he's so modest. It's just painful how modest he is sometimes.
Too modest.
Great artist and lovely guy. Yeah. But David, yeah, we have actually been talking for an hour and 40 minutes. Can you believe that?
I can.
It's my longest interview yet.
Really?
Yeah. It's been
such a windbag.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. It really has.
It's great chatting to you as well.
Yeah, it's been good to catch up. And I've genuinely really enjoyed all the stuff we've talked about. And I've learned stuff I didn't know about you, you know, because as much as you know, I could read stuff online, we can talk in the bars and stuff like that. But there's just so much work that you've done. And so thank you for sharing your time.
Well, thank you.
And it's been an absolute pleasure. And I'll see you hopefully, you know, very soon.
We will get back together hopefully next year for the next lot of ICE conventions across the land.
I will be in touch about that. Thanks again, David, and all the best to you, mate.